This, even this, is for the praise and glory of God. Everything that we do. And to celebrate his children who are growing older is as important as anything else we do. And if you listen to me, you'll be convinced that it's much more important than a lot of things. And I have to refer us back to the scripture text, Galatians 6:2. Bear you one another's burdens. That's what we're doing. And I want to stop for a second and talk about what I see happening here in Holden in that respect of bearing each other's burdens, even beyond older people. But I have seen some cross-generational things happening too. I've had conversations with people that just by standing and talking, I feel that things have been added to my life worthwhile. For instance, I remember the first conversation we had, Dick. When I walked away from that, I actually sent someone else over to talk to you. I say, go talk to that man. And I think it might have been Eve. I'm not sure. Because I felt that just in a few minutes, there was just a wealth of information. And that you are someone who's bearing others' burdens in what you do, in the work that you do out in the wilderness. That is definitely bearing someone else's burdens. And Mrs. Harris, when I was listening to your talk, you are definitely bearing someone else's burdens, and you have been. And it doesn't mean that you're walking around like this. It simply means that you have made it known to other people that you care about what's going on with them, and you care about the world, and you care about individuals. And there's not one of you sitting here. You wouldn't be in this workshop if you didn't know what that meant, to carry one another's burdens and thus fulfill the law of God. And for me personally, the Deuteronomy 5:16 thing is important. Honor your mother and your father so that it will go well with you in the land your father's given you. Those go together. My mother and my father, not just the people who gave birth to my life, my mother and my father, like Mrs. McDade, or any person who has done anything to offer me some nurturing. Also, that obligation for me to extend myself to other people goes beyond the parents. God gave me the natural parents. It is up to me to extend myself to anyone that I see needs it. And there are times when I have to confess, and I think we all have to confess, that there are times when I have seen needs and have said that I'm busy right now. And I'm going to give an example of something that the Lord has worked with me on right now. And I believe in putting stories in, because at this moment, this little incident is important, because this is in the way of a confession and, on one hand, a lesson learned about not being too busy. If I'm going to stand here in front of you and talk about reaching out to older people, don't want you to get the impression that I've always been able to do this. It's something God has taught me over the years to learn how to do, in all honesty. But I can tell you that I think since a little girl, I've always had this special connection to older people. But there's a woman who passes by my house every day. And I think her name is Young. Her last name is Young. And her husband just recently died, but she passes by with her dog. And I know her daughter and her son and her grandchildren went to school with mine. And she talks a lot. I mean, endlessly. This is what God, he said, you ask me for some patience, I'm going to show you what patience is. And she would come around the corner the same time every day. And I caught myself in a situation where I really had to check myself, running away from the door at times when I knew I had to cook. And I thought, how long have I done this to her? Because I know the time I walk out, she just plunges right in. It's like we've already been talking. And she'll come right in and say, yes, because... And she just go in the conversation, talk about her, like, oh, I gotta meet a person, and the minute I meet somebody, I'm gonna tell them this. And it took me a few minutes to realize, wait a minute, this is loneliness. What are you talking about? You're gonna stand in a seminar and tell people about touching and reaching out to older people, and you see Mrs. Young coming, and just because you wanted to get the chicken fried before Jimmy comes in and you want him to eat, and you know you got to go to a church meeting. This is church, lady. You know, this is the church meeting right here in front of your house. And the Lord says, whoa, hold it, stop. What are we talking about? Just preaching some principles? Or Leona, advocate of old age, peace and communication. We're talking about giving yourself. Go in there, put the chicken in the refrigerator, and go out there and expose yourself and stand and wait until she comes. Expose yourself to the situation here. So, I noticed one day she was coming by, and I stood and talked with her quite a bit. She was coming, and I started this. And the Lord said, nope, this way. So, I went back, and I stood at the door. And she passed by, and she started, she almost sensed. I think she sensed, and I felt so bad. She has sensed that I don't want to talk long. What have I done? What have I said here? And she started to go on. And I said, Mrs. Young. And I went outside, and I stood there and had the most delightful blessing. I didn't want to leave, and you know what happened, ironically? I wanted to go on with the conversation, and she said, well, I got to go now. And I wanted to say, well, wait a minute, I want to talk. Because she had completed her conversation, and it's the first time I've known her to end the conversation. She said, I got to go now. And I said, well, Lord, I guess you knew. I extended myself, and I guess you wanted to show me, huh? Yeah, God, you got a great sense of humor. And so now, I see her coming, and I feel more relaxed, that I can just, I don't care. Okay, so it's time to do something else. 15 minutes. And there are other instances of that kind. I've been in the store, and one of my biggest problems has been in a hurry. And God is telling me, be still and know that I'm God. That's what it's about right now. And I have to admit, I mean, there are those instances where I wanted to go to the other aisle. I don't have time right now. I know he's going to want to ask me about, and he's never going to be, I've got to get, goodness gracious, it's getting late. And the Lord said, that aisle. So, I found myself one morning 30 minutes in the store when I was supposed to rush right out to do something I wanted to do. And stood there, and once again, the blessing came. It turned out that this woman needed to talk to somebody about her child and who was not doing too well in school, and I'm a teacher, and she was looking for that from me. So I had to stop. And she was a little older than I am, but just a couple of years. But she was someone who needed someone to bear her burdens at that time. So, again, as I talk, I found myself working out some things that I had been thinking about. And it just got so good to me. And then she said, well, I guess I better let you go. That was my cue that I would normally say, yeah, well, I do have some stuff to do. I found myself saying, well, I'm in no hurry. I lie. I was. But I had been checked by the Lord. That you're only in a hurry this morning because you want to be, not because I want you to be. You're in a hurry because you have something you want to do. It's not on my agenda for you. So just check my agenda right now. My agenda is that you stand here and talk with her for a while. And she's not to feel your anxiety at all. Because if that happens, then I haven't connected. And you know what he does in moments like that? You look up and you're no longer anxious. You're relaxed and you're finding yourself enjoying it. That's what I mean when I talk about bearing one another's burdens. That's one of the things. It goes from anything from a moment in a grocery store to a wilderness walk to whatever, you name it. You can name it. You could probably rattle off 10, 12, 15 right now, each of you. Situations where you had to put yourself in a situation where you were going to carry someone else's burden. One other thing I like to remind people of when we talk about carrying burdens, it means with a smile. Now, that's not written in that particular text, but I know that's what God had in mind, because there are places where he does talk about with joy. It doesn't mean that you let, oh, this thing is so hard. Well, let me tell you what I had to do. Girl, I just had to go up there and just help her all day long. And I just did this and I did that. And I got so tired of it. And I just, you know, I sometimes I just don't want to. And you're glorifying yourself. I'm guilty. I've done it. You're glorifying yourself. And the Lord said to the Pharisees, I didn't intend to preach this. I didn't come in here to preach. I'm here to talk. But these are feelings that I feel that are very important. And he said about the Pharisees, they're getting theirs now, because they're standing there out in the public praising themselves. They're getting theirs now. So I don't have to give it to them. So when we stop mumbling and grumbling about these things that we're doing, extending ourselves, that's when our blessings flow. So it's not, it's sort of an investment too, isn't it? You invest in your own blessings as well. Okay. I think we talked enough about the shut-in and shut-out. You know, the shut-in in the convalescent homes. Those shut-out, just ways like I'm talking now, that I was shutting that woman out. I know I was doing that. And these assumptions that we make, that they don't need, we agreed yesterday, yes, they do want intimacy with us. Yes, they do need laughter, and they have laughter to give. And yes, we must sit at their feet, because there is wisdom to be gotten. How many of you have not heard me tell the story of Mary Jane McDade yet? Okay, a couple of people. I'll just say briefly that she is a woman who knew what bearing people's burdens was all about. When my husband had two children, an older woman who didn't know her age but gave out so much love and wisdom, who became grandmother to my children, mother to us away from home. Who extended herself in ways at the same time we became her family. And I never will forget the night we moved away. We were living in back of her. And she cried. She said, we were just going to Richmond. She said, but it's not the same. I can't see the kids when they come by the window. And that just, I hadn't thought of that. I hadn't thought how she was watching us. She'd be in her house sometimes, at times when I didn't want to babysit, and I needed her for other things too, not realizing that she was waiting for us to get up and pass by her house to go to the store. And she said, but I can't see them when they do that. And so we made a point of going out back to Oakland and into Richmond to bring her to her house. And she said, when I first brought her there, she said, you ready? I thought sure you guys were going to forget me. And I thought, this woman doesn't know yet what she means to us. And one of the saddest things was when she became senile. How many of you have had that experience, that someone you love didn't know you anymore? That was a hard one. It was the first time I experienced it. I felt, ooh, all that connectedness. But then the Lord consoled me by saying, through me, you still are connected. You still are. She doesn't know it mentally, but there is a part of you that's in her still. And once that connection happens, the Lord is in that connection, it stays. And I know I wouldn't be able to talk to her anymore. I knew that. And not where she would know who I am. I knew that. But somehow I was able to remember that. Oh, memories are so important. Memory building is so important in children's lives. I was able to remember that. And Bridget and Jimmy now, who are 23 and 24, remember Mrs. McDade. And when we mention her, the younger children who didn't know her, they're missing out. They don't know who this Mrs. McDade was. So Bridget and Jimmy can tell them who she was. And that's precious. I've been using my voice an awful lot, so excuse that. I want to do The other two things here, I promised you that I was going to finish up Hands in the Mirror, and I'm going to do that. But also, the most important part of this session to me, always, is the sharing that you give. And I believe that today's session is probably, I'm not sure, going to be a little bit shorter, simply because a lot of you have shared already. But I want you to be free to bring in other people. I know there's just more, it's got to be more than one person in your life that you would celebrate. I want to get the most out of this last workshop because, as I said before, I'm not the only person in here giving. I have an ulterior motive. I'm getting a lot from you guys too, see. But you think I came in here to give something, don't you? Well, I got news for you. I came here to get something. It works both ways. And in all honesty, I want to know these people that you know. And it's hard for me to explain how come that's important to me. And I don't think I have to explain it. It just is. Okay, I'm going to read, for the sake of those who didn't hear the Mary Jane McDade poem, I'm going to read that one. Then we'll do some sharing, and then I'm going to finish. Oh, I'm also going to read one about my mother and father. I'm going to celebrate them today. Okay? Okay. Her hair has become like the gray of an ageless Mississippi moss. Her face wears the emblem of fulfilled years, unrewarded. And time is unaware that she is there. Her yesterday brings no celebrations for today, and her today is a collection of yesterday's faded, dry-rotted doilies, locked tight in a stale, snuff-scented room. And time is unaware that she is there. An untaught scholar with a human degree in live and let live, and time is unaware that she is there. But I was aware, and my husband was aware, and when I took her to my poetry readings and stood her up and said, this is Mrs. McDade that I'm writing about, they were aware. And when the newspaper article came out with her name in it about the poetry, and she said, honey, you're going to make me feel like Miss Ann around here if you keep this up, they were aware. And now there are some people in the world who know Mary Jane McDade. As I promised her, I said, they're going to know you through the poetry. John and Alan. Can I go first?
Sure.
Can I celebrate first? Okay.
What's your mother's name?
My mother's name is Aline.
Aline
Nicholas. And, and my father's name was John. I want to tell you about him first. He's dead. He's been dead about 6 years. John Nicholas was a man whose name is synonymous to love and laughter. And everybody knew him that way. I mean, we'd be in Mississippi somewhere. So I'm like, oh yeah, John, you're John's daughter. If you were John's daughter, you were somebody. He was an orderly in a hospital. He was an orderly for 45 years in the same hospital. I mean, that's what we grew up on, my father being an orderly. Now, I have always known that he should have been a doctor. Had circumstances been different, he would have been a doctor. I was convinced the first time he brought home a penicillin and gave us a shot when we had colds. He used to do that. He knew what he was doing, because he used to work in the surgery thing. But most importantly was people's attitudes toward him. He was known as the orderly whose floor you wanted to be on. So people would come from miles and say, put me on John Nicholas's floor. And he was particularly good with the clergy for some reason, because there was an honorary archbishop that no one could do a thing with when he came to the hospital. And they would say, get John in here. My daddy had this way. He would walk in and he would simply say, now, archbishop. I mean, what can you do after someone says to you, now, archbishop? And he would say to my mother, now, Aline. And he had a nickname for me. He called me Jemima, because I used to put these on my head when I went to bed at night. I put these and tied up, and no one else could call me that but him. He said, now, Jemima. I mean, what else can you do but fall into check, right? And he'd look at you and talk and laugh, and he just had this marvelous sense of humor and this laughter. Well, when he died, the Archbishop Lipscomb in Mobile did his funeral in the cathedral, as he was that special to him. And he gave a sermon which captured my father's life. He talked about John's floor. And in the end, when he finished his sermon, and I have a poem called that, I didn't bring that one with me, he said, "Lord, when we all leave, please see that we get on John's floor." And that was it. So I wrote a poem. I didn't bring John's floor with me, but I do have another one up. I went away 2 months after that to a place called the Gerasi Foundation. It's in the Redwoods in Oakland, where artists from all over the world are invited to live on the place. You talk about acres of natural land and do their thing. And so I wrote this book, and it was a beautiful community theme because, well, there was a weaver from Scotland, and there was a sculptor from New York, and there were people from all over, and they helped me to bind this little book of collection of poems of my father. We were up midnight having a book binding party to do this, and they took part in that. So I wrote a poem that day called "Daughter of a Prince." Daughter of a Prince, that's what I am when I think of my father. Now, let me tell you a little bit about what's happening in this poem. I always felt very self-conscious about taking my father's money. I mean, I never took any more than I needed. Like, if he said, if I needed some loose leaf paper and it cost a nickel, I wouldn't ask for 50 cents like everybody else. And I just felt like he needed his money. And all my sisters and brothers were grabbing, you know, and my dad was a very handsome man, and he used Vitalis in his hair. And he used to be so handsome when he went, one of the things he had to do was to serve the doctor's staff meetings. And when he went, he would wear black pants, white shirt with a black tie, and he put his Vitalis on. If you go into the room, that smell, that, when I think of him, I think of that. I mean, just see him there, and I thought, wow, I got a good looking daddy. Okay, so I wrote "The Daughter of a Prince." He robs the last smidgens of Vitalis into the softness of his wavy luster black hair. Straightens the already straight black bow tie, hooks it securely into the argo stiffness of his white shirt collar, and smiles. Soft generosity set in his face, he asks, "How much, Jemima?" 50 cents, I hold back, because Daddy might need his money. There, one hand reaches for the chiffon robe keys. The other points at the pile of loose change on the dresser. There must be a whole $2 there. He would give it all to me. Loose leaf only costs a nickel. I stand teasing myself with the shine of pennies, nickels, and dimes. But more, far more entrancing at the moment, is the shine of the man. He stands, a prince with Vitalis and aftershave surety, regal stature and royal sapience. He knows the smell, the stance, the movement of dignity. He is a prince. The tan white gleam of his skin, smooth and seeping clean, makes him so. The keys to the old freedom wagon are his scepter as he turns to leave the room. His gait, swift, aimful, and supreme, marking his processional air. He has to go and serve. I return to the coins and secure 50 cents, because Daddy might need his money. Royalty encompasses me. I am rich. Some because I stand with 50 cents in my palm. Some because I stand in his room, redolent of sweet alkaline and soap. But more, much more, I am rich because I stand in the life of this man. I stand in his shine. Today he is gone, yet I am still rich. I am the daughter of a prince. Yeah. Now there's a good That was hard to capture, because I didn't want to miss a lick. But now there's a different picture of my mother. This is in the kitchen at night. Let me tell you what her favorite pastime was. Celebrating Eileen Nicholas here. Sipping Lipton tea at night. And greasing her hair. What we did with our hair was a thing we call greasing it. And Vaseline was used for everything, even oiling the scalp of the hair, putting on the legs, you know, getting the ashy dryness off. You just use Vaseline. And that's what she used for her hair, right? Okay, we call it greasing the hair. This is the poem. Is there something biting you? Oh, okay.
I took a shower.
The fly is still there.
Yeah.
Okay. This is called Love Was, Warm Kitchen Vapors and Midnight Smells. I got hungry and got up. She was there, sipping Lipton and greasing her hair. I got hungry and got up. She was there. Some white potatoes in a sack, she said, while she rubbed Vaseline in her head. Fried potatoes good before going to bed. They got hungry and got up. We were there, sipping Lipton while she greased her hair. French fries soaking on a brown paper bag, what's left over from what I had. Warm kitchen vapors and midnight smells. Sipping Lipton, she cares. Passing fries, I care. Biting one and passing it on, they care. Cause she was sipping Lipton and greasing her hair. That's Aline and John, 9 children, 8 of us still living. Now you celebrate. Questions? Wow.
Does it take you long to make poems like that?
Yes and no, and I'll tell you why I say that. Everybody has a creative process, and mine is incubation. It might take longer for the poem to incubate in me. I get the idea, I get the feeling, and it doesn't come out, and it's got to stay there inside of me someplace, nurturing itself all on its own. My poems usually have to get their beginning by themselves, because they're there. I seldom go out searching for anything at all, period. It's just there. Now, once that has happened, from my consciousness to the paper, no. I would say that poem might have taken about 20 minutes to write. But then I might have spent another 10 minutes polishing it. And then at some point a year or so later, another 5 minutes redoing it. So if I had to collect the time, I would say a poem like that would take me about, if I had to put the time together, about 45 minutes or so. There are poems that have taken 5. And there's a poem that it took me about a month to write, not because I was in that process, physical process, but because the incubation, it just didn't happen for me the way I wanted it to, and it finally did. Then I had that one poem that I dreamed and woke up and was able to write it just the way it came. That's
well, now, where do you get your inspirations? Now, I can see your mother and father.
Yeah, it's just all over.
Like, I mean, while you're in your car going to work?
I've come up with a lot of stuff driving.
Mm-hmm.
At the kitchen sink, I've gotten inspiration. I've gotten inspiration out of the beach. I've gotten inspiration from just things happening in my life, things I hear going on. Sometimes things come so fast that I don't have time to put it down. I have outlines and things started. I have poems and plays and essays and things that I've begun that one day somebody's going to have to say, you sit down and I'm giving you all this money to do it because you don't have to go to work. You don't have to go to work. I don't know what you're paid for doing the art. But let's face reality here. If someone said, I'm going to give you a year salary just to write, no, that would just be great. Do I have any takers on that?
Come live at our house.
Where's your house?
In Seattle?
Okay, all right. I can bring, let's see. Oh, we don't have a dog right now.
We can't take more than one.
Oh. Just the artist.
Just the artist.
And that's what I would probably need to do is leave them behind.
That
really.
One of your father, your wording is, I mean, you really paint a picture and put us, you know, we just can taste it.
Mm-hmm.
Just the way you put those words.
And you know, I had to do that when I was there. It was like, okay, Daddy, I got to do this right. Because I'm trying to tell them about you. And you weren't in a half-stepper. You know, he wasn't. I mean, my daddy was not I don't remember my dad hitting me twice in my life. And one, I can see how he did it because I almost rolled my little sister's neck up in the car. He just went, you know, he saw it through the rearview mirror. I wasn't watching what I was doing. And he went, psh. And the other time, I will never forget it. I'm going to tell this. Am I being unfair? I promised you were going to talk. You are.
You're talking more about yourself than your father, I think.
Yes, that's probably true, to a certain extent, because he was so much, so close to me. When I was 5 years old, I got a new pair of pedal pushers. You know what those are? Mm-hmm. They're wearing them now. They don't call them that. Yep. And so he said, now don't you get wet when you go to the pool, to the park. Don't you get in that pool, don't you get wet. And I was innocent. I declare I was innocent. I reached over in the pool to touch the water. This little boy pulled my hand, pulled me in. And I went home. And my daddy had this saying. He had this saying, because he had told me he was going to do this, and he had to live up to it. It was, I'm going to make you jump the berries. To me, that meant I'm going to switch your legs, and you're going to be jumping all around. He called it jumping the berries, right? So he said, Leona, I told you. And he took his little switch, and he switched my legs. And he said, I said, but Daddy, the little boy pulled me over. And he said, I told you not to get wet. Switch. And that was the only spanking I remember him. I mean, he laid it on my brothers, but that was the only spanking I remember.
Mama's boy, daddy's girl. Yeah.
I think that's probably what it was, really. And so anyway, that is John Nicholas. And we celebrate him and her and my mother. Okay, now. Some of you were not here and didn't get to tell us about some of the people we were going to celebrate in your lives. And some of you who were might have some other people. Let's celebrate some people.
Do you ever celebrate people that were not real pleasant?
Oh, yes. Yes, by all means, tell me about it. Tell us about it.
I had a great aunt. And her name was Selma. Only we always called her Girly. And she, when she was young, was a nurse. And she had fallen in love with a doctor, and he was in love with her, but he was divorced.
Mm-hmm.
And her mother was a widow. Her husband had died, my great aunt's father had died when she was like two, or mm-hmm. even when she was born. So this mother had raised her, and her mother refused to give her permission to marry this doctor. Told her she could not marry this doctor because he was divorced. So Girly never ever
married.
Had any more joy in her life. It was as if. I mean, she was, when you thought old maid, that was her.
Mm.
She was not happy.
Tragedy.
She was not fun to be around. I would be around her out of guilt because we would go and get her for Christmas. And one time she said to me, our oldest was about two, and she said to me, you don't know what you have with your husband and your little girl. Mm. And I said to her, I do know mm-hmm. what I have. And she got sick, and it was not, that wasn't pleasant, and she was living by herself, and she lived in a, she wouldn't move, she lived in a not a very pleasant apartment. It was all cinder block. And she just, I hate to say it, but it was a relief that she died.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying.
She was never happy, and she was never, I dreaded calling her because she didn't like talking on the phone, mm-hmm, uh-huh. So it was really hard to mm-hmm. have a relationship with her.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I want to celebrate what could have been with her.
And it doesn't have to be a celebration.
Or maybe just an acknowledgement.
Yes. And also, just as we celebrate people with you, we can also share the sorrow of a tragedy. Because that's what that was.
Yeah, she was a tragic.
Yes.
She loved beautiful things and had been a nurse. She'd been a private duty nurse. So she would go to wealthy, she lived in Berkeley.
Mm.
She would go to wealthy people and take care of them when they were sick in their home.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so she saw this life that she could never really have. But she always, she had beautiful little things. She would save her money and buy, you know, a nice painting or a piece.
Things, yeah.
Sculpture, and she'd always look at Holiday magazine because it would show beautiful places you could visit.
Things, and she was dreaming through it all.
She never traveled.
That's tragic.
Yeah.
It's like serving the doctors.
Yes.
It's like they're, I mean, that doing things for people that you will never be like.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is tremendous education.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And it comes to many of us.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's true. But what she said to you, though, when she was telling you that you have, what you have is great, actually, she knew you knew it. What she was saying is, I wish that I had
it. Well,
I
know. It was a very painful thing to hear.
And the tragedy there, the real tragedy, is the love that passed right under her nose. That she's holding on to what could have been, and it's gone. There's no telling what other man, for that matter, as far as a husband is concerned, but the other people, nieces and the nephews, and maybe sisters and brothers, maybe her own mother. I could imagine that there was a lot unresolved.
Oh, yes, yes.
Wow. Yeah, so we certainly do need to talk about those kinds of things.
When she got sick, she was in the hospital, and I went to see her. She talked like she was back with this doctor.
Oh.
That was, in a way, that was really interesting.
She never let him go.
Oh, no.
Did he go on with his life, I wonder?
I think he did marry, yeah. Ooh. So she died when she was 92, and this she died about...
Oh, such a blessed long life.
Not a blessed long life.
No, I mean such a blessed, not content-wise, but she was given a number of years blessed with those to use.
Yeah.
That's a tragedy, yes.
It was a tragedy.
Oh, boy. Well, glad you shared that. Because
I mean,
these kinds of stories often come out when we talk. It's not always a pretty picture.
No.
It doesn't have to be. Is there anyone else who has a story to share?
Yes. I celebrate my grandmother. Her name was Effie. Effie, long gone. Effie had three sons, one of them being my father, of course. One died in a boating accident. At the time, he was a young man and just engaged to be married. His fiance was alone. The other one died probably in his early 40s. So my father was her only living son during most of her later years. She was baptized in the Mormon Church, and she remembered the tabernacle in, the temple in Salt Lake City when it was new. Mm-hmm. And I used to ask her, what was it like inside, you know? Mm-hmm. But she was too little. All she could remember was the stairway. She said it was the most grand stairway she'd ever seen. But she was too little to really remember mm-hmm. much. But then, as I say, she grew up a Mormon, and then she joined the Lutheran Church because it happened to be nearby.
Yeah.
When she was older, and she was baptized then in the Mormon Church. And then in her very latest years, she lived in a Baptist
home.
And she decided she was going to live in a Baptist. She was going to be baptized. So she was baptized three times.
Oh, she believed in baptism, didn't she?
She never lived in Baptist, but she wanted to be like the one she was with. In my grandfather's later years, he had hardening of the arteries and lost his mind. She kept him at home as long as she could. And I guess I learned from her a certain amount of persistence in dealing with the tragedies, the deaths of her sons, and with this illness. She found that reading to him from the Bible was one thing that would calm him. So she spent many hours just simply reading to him while he was doing these rather bizarre things.
Mm-hmm.
She had two grandchildren, myself and another cousin. And whenever we would do little things for her in her later years, she would give us money.
Uh-huh.
I'd type a letter for her, and she'd leave $5 on my dresser. And it rather angered my father. He was saying, you know, you're going to need this money one of these days. You can't be giving to the kids for things that she'd be doing for you anyway. Mm-hmm. But she would insist, and she's not going to die before it's gone. I'm going to die before it's gone. And the day came when her money was gone, and she did apply for welfare, and she died before she got the first check.
Mm. Isn't that something? She knew.
Time was over, right.
That's something.
But she was, you know, people talk about when they have these near-death experiences that someone comes to meet them, and I'm quite convinced that grandma's going to meet me someday.
Uh-huh.
I feel very close to her, more so than any relative I've ever lost.
Uh-huh. Effie, did you say what's the name? Any other celebrations before we go into the poetry? some more poetry, but I want to hear your stories here. Bill.
Yeah, I like to celebrate my mother. A few years ago, I had an illness, and I was hospitalized for 10 months, confined to a hospital bed because I had to have a series of surgeries, and when they would complete one, they couldn't let me go home. They had to keep me there so they could see, mm-hmm. you know, my blood count and how I was healing up before they could go to a step two. And at first I was in the hospital in Tacoma, where I'm from. But then I had to be moved to Seattle because of the high technology.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother, I'm talking 10 months, she would catch a city bus from Tacoma to a transfer point halfway to Seattle.
Mm.
And then she would get on a Seattle bus and go to the hospital. Now coming home, she would have to do the same thing. And she did this for 10 straight months.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times in the hospital I was very evil because, like when I was in Vietnam, I had a way to vent my frustrations.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're hospitalized, you just have to lay there and take it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was becoming a very bitter person, a hard patient to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I would wake up and I would curse God for allowing me to live for another day of pain and unhappiness.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved my mother very much, but after the months started building up, I would take out my frustrations on her.
Mm-hmm.
But she would just sit there and not say nothing. Next day she'd be there again, and the next day, and the next day. And it is an adventure to go from Tacoma.
Really? You went on the bus.
But, you know, she was there, you know, every day. And eventually when I came home, you know, I really didn't know what it was. You know, I guess I couldn't appreciate what she did. But then mm-hmm. I remember one night I was convalescing at my mother's house, and I started crying because of all the things I remembered that I had said and behaved,
mm-hmm.
and I felt very bad about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then while I was convalescing, my mother she would always get on me, why don't you go to church with me on Sunday? And so I got tired of her nagging me, so I just figured, okay, I'll go to church, okay. Now I went to the church for a couple of weeks, and I really started feeling comfortable in
mm-hmm.
church.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I found Jesus, and mm-hmm. I became confirmed in the Lutheran faith.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole experience has really been a revelation. I have received so many gifts in my life. My mother put up with all the negativity. She was there supporting me all the time,
mm-hmm.
as a good mother does. And still she does keep on supporting me. And through her, I found Christ.
Amen.
And with the experiences I've learned, it made me more of a giving person because for so many months, people were giving to me.
Uh-huh.
And now I want to give it back to God's people.
Mm.
And if it hadn't been for my mother, I probably would have still been a very negative person. You know, to myself,
yeah.
shut my door.
Uh-huh.
But through her, I found Christ, and I'm more outgoing. I'm not really a whole lot of outgoing, but
yeah.
I'm more outgoing than what I was, and I'm not bitter or negative like I used to be.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just thankful for God to give me a mother like that, to show me Christ.
What's your mother's name?
Betty.
Betty.
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful testimony. Have you given that to your mother?
Pardon?
Have you said those things to her?
Yes, I have, many times. And I'm 42 right now. And sometimes, well, you know, I'm the only child.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes when I'm out with my mother, she'll bother me.
Yeah, of course.
And it doesn't bother me anymore because I know she means
his
well.
His grandmother, yes.
So, you know, I can tolerate it, and I don't get offended by it. And I'm more loving, and I hug my mother more now.
Oh, good.
I do.
Good. Oh, that's great.
I'm blessed.
Really. Final word on it. I'm blessed. You are indeed. Thanks, Bill. That's beautiful. Really. Any other testimonies, or do you want me to share a couple of poems with you right now? Should I?
Fine.
Okay. All right. I'm so consumed by that testimony. That's beautiful. That you got so much. You got the relationship with your mother. But she was so strong to do that. I don't live in these parts, but I know the distance in those cities. And she must have been good physical health. And that's a blessing. But ultimately, you found Christ through her. To be able to, I want my kids to say, if they don't say anything else about me, I want them to say, if my mother didn't give me anything else, she gave me Jesus Christ.
I was so evil. I guess a lot of mothers would say, okay, you don't want me around you, I won't come around.
But she didn't do that. Because she loved her boy.
She supported me.
Loved her boy.
Even when I cursed God, she supported me.
Well, that's what grace is. He can be as bad as he is, but she's just going to keep on loving you. And that's the kind of grace we get from
him. That's it.
Well, I'm a 42-year-old mama's boy.
42
years old, a mama's boy.
That's all right, though.
Yeah.
That her love is unconditional for you, the kind we're supposed to get. But it sounds like yours has become unconditional too, for her. Okay, let's see. What poem did I not share with you out of Hands in the Mirror? Most of you who were here know that I've been reading from a Coria poem, Poem to Be Danced, focusing on the hands of old black women celebrating their roles in our lives that I wrote some years ago, maybe 5 or 6, that being some years ago. And it happens to be one of my favorite pieces. This one is entitled Poem on a Sunday Morning. Now, I grew up a Catholic, but I'm now in the Baptist church. But when I wrote this, I knew about some of my... I'm sort of mingling what I know about in the Baptist experience with my own in a way. Anyway, the church situation isn't what is important here. The important thing is the way my grandmother related to me. Remember I told you about that switch?
Yeah.
In her purse, when she went to church, she had this little switch, and she would show it to us. Man, what I say? You don't want me to use this, do you? And she never had to. She just had to show it to me. I mean, all you had to do was show me. You didn't have to prove to me that you would use it. My brothers, she had to prove it to them. But I scared real easily. I mean, you just look at me. You know that look, every mother has that look. And you know what? I think I've developed one. And in my class. And I just look at this person for a long time, and I see them going like this, just what I want them to do. Get real little. That's right. It's power. That's power. I'm going to own up to it. I did it to me, and by golly, I got to get back. But anyway, she didn't have to say a lot of words to me. I stood at the door of her room, watching her as she painstakingly shoved the last button of her jacket through the hole, stuck a small switch from the peach tree in her purse for me if I got fidgety in church, and gave her white pearl hat pin one final easy tap to be sure it was right. Looked over at me with it, now you mind what I said, look, and motioned me out the door with her black patent leather pocketbook. Sunday morning, and the world was another whole different color now. The blues from Saturday night had turned to gold and purple, because praising the Lord is a mighty royal affair. No, sir, no church, nowhere, for no reason, could boast of the royal crown and Dixie peach heads and the Vaseline legs. No church, nowhere, for no reason, able to boast of a more proud usher board and blue gabardine suit deacon bench like ours. I used to go to these other churches, too. No church could out-rock, out-shake, or out-amen ours on Sunday morning. No church, nowhere, for no reason. I sit on the inside of the pew next to her and watch her out the side of my eye. I could close my eyes, though, and tell you exactly what she'd be doing. I could see her hands, color of the maple dining room table in our house, and just as plump and round. Incidentally, the subtitle for this is For My Baptist Friends. Okay, mm-hmm. I need to tell you that. I could see her hands, colors of the maple dining room table in our house, and just as plump and round as the table legs, hands sticking out from under her arms where she had them folded. Her short, fat dining room table leg hands just be patting her side from under her arm, and her short, fat right foot be thumping on the floor as the choir claps and sings. She never patted her left foot, cause it sometimes hurt a lot and got stiff on her. But I could see how even her left foot sometimes wanted to pat a little too. But it never did work up a real pat. Just twitched a bit now and then like it wanted to pat some. I keep my eyes on her hand, because that way I know that she won't be reaching for the peach switch in her pocketbook if I drop my tight nickel four times. Now and then the hand would jerk from under her arm, and I'm just about to jump off my seat, but all she did with it was clap four or five times, and back under her arm it went. I would sit Sunday after Sunday and watch this ritual, watch her short, fat, thumpy, round hand tap, tap under the arm, clap, clap, back again, tap, tap, until the final benediction was asked. And it was time to be kissed by everybody at the back door and then go home. And oh yes, when I was asked later what the preacher had spoke on that morning, all I could think of was her hand, that right-sided one, patting, clapping. And I was standing there looking ready to run or pretend like I was going to answer in a minute. But all I could remember was that hand. Now, what I've done here is mingle some experiences of mine with some experiences of my friend to come up with a portrait of a woman. Okay, now, let's see. I think I've just about... No, I've got a couple more here you haven't heard. There's one I want to redo for the sake of those who were not here yesterday. And that is the poem of the cooking pot, Grandma's Hands. Now, you will notice that from poem to poem, I'm describing different hands because I'm not talking about the same person. I have visions in my mind of several older black women, and I've used the hands that I wanted to use. The one you heard, Poem of Knowing and Caring, was my grandmother. My grandmother was a cook, too. I don't mean she cooked professional. She was a jack of all trades, that's what we called her. Let me give you an idea about what this woman could do. When we first got our house, it was a small one. So my grandmother and her sons, build the rest of the house. I mean, she saw the boards and helped with the plans, and she nailed the boards in. However, there was one agreement that I think was a mistake, turned out, I think, to be, that she would always have a room in our house. Now, my mother lived some pretty hard times behind that. 35 years, my grandmother lived with us. It was only later that when she moved out, and the ironic thing here is that my father later suffered a stroke, and I remember how happy my mother was to have him to herself, even in those conditions, that my grandmother could do everything. She was the one who did the sewing. She was the one who could cook. And when they got married, my mother was like her daughter. And so the marriage was like she was the daughter. And my mother suffered a bit behind that. Now, my grandmother wasn't there all the time because she traveled around a lot. And she wasn't mean to my mother. It's just that when one person in the house can do it all, that's who we all run to, you see. And so she played my mother played second fiddle. My grandmother could do it all. And even my mother depended, and I think that was an early mistake too. She depended on my grandmother's skills too much, I think. And in either case, there were times when it created problems, and you must know it had to. But it wasn't a tragedy. It's just that my mother says, I don't care what it becomes like for me, don't you ever bring me into your home to live. She lives in a senior citizen home, and she's happy. And she's saying, that's where I'm going to stay. I don't want to live with any of you, not because I don't want to, but because I don't want you to have me living with you. This is called Poem of a Cooking Pot, Black-eyed pea juice simmering on the back eye of the stove. Yellow corn bubbling in the boiling pot. Chicken frying hot in the black cast iron fry. Smell of grandma's kitchen tickling my nose and teasing me alive. Waking me up in the middle of a heated summer day. Bubbling, simmering vapors drifting out through the back window where I doze, waiting for the call. Y'all come on now. Her hands moving faster than a yellow jacket from honeysuckle to honeysuckle. Her hands stirring gravy, gravy brown hands, a sea captain on the steer whipping up a storm in the kitchen. Fingers long, skinny, kneading dough, a masseuse in a biscuit parlor, kneading it to health. An orchestra, two hands blending in harmony of taste, maestro synchronizing flavors to the tune of boiling pots. Long fingers skipping over floured pork chops, sliding across yellow corn ears, thumping at the edge of pots. Melodies of a cooking pot teasing my ears, waking me in the middle of a hot summer day. Hisses and bubbles bouncing keyboard-like on the breeze. Drum majoring out the back door where I wait for the call. I say it, y'all come on now. Her hands moving faster than a yellow jacket in a honeysuckle vine. Her hands stirring gravy, gravy brown hands, stirring up a melody for my hungry ears and nose. Gravy brown hands making songs for the cooking pot. Ragtime keys, jazz time peas, hot jazz simmering under my nose, humming under my tongue, waking me up. Her hands stirring gravy, gravy brown hands, moving faster than a yellow jacket in a honeysuckle vine, stirring up a melody for my soul. Okay, we have time for one more here. I'm going to close this thing off now. What do I want to do? I haven't done... Okay. Poem for a Tired Old Woman. And this was definitely Mary Jane McDade who influenced this poem. I did Wisdom, Age, and Loneliness, didn't I? Yeah, okay. An exuberant prayer. All right. Sun beaten down on the pavement, pork chop frying hot. Sun beaten down on a gray kinked head. She wore her overcoat this morning when she left to do her shopping. Never can tell when it might turn off cool. Sighs, a fool always carries hers. Brown paper bag in her arms, too heavy to tote along with the coat. She keeps the coat on her already heavy back in spite of the sun. Got to get this shopping done. Heavy, cold, black hands, thin and boned, clutching the sides of the bag, reaching across the vegetable bin, long fingers tugging at the collard leaf, making sure. Heavy, cold, black hands, tugging at the side of the bag, pointing across the meat counter. That and there. Best hop you got. Gray, kinked head, trudging under the sun. Got to get this shopping done. Make some ham bone soup for Brud Jenkins. Check came yesterday. Three chops. Grits, Maxwell House coffee, coat getting heavier, keep it on in spite of the sun, got to get this shopping done. Old black woman trudging down the street, heavy brown paper bag, sore tired feet, covered a million years times 10 million more, lived a million lifetimes, trudging to and fro, head rag tied over gray kinked head, back bent, dragging on, heart full of lead. What is she toting in that big brown bag? A ton of bitter black bread for every year she's had. Tired old woman, weary in your soul, lay your paper bag down, let your tale be told. What is she toting in that big brown bag? A ton of bitter black bread for every year she's had. Tired old woman, weary in your soul, lay your paper bag down, let your tale be told.